Are you tired of wasting your time on print-related tickets? PrinterLogic offers a centralized, cloud-native, IP-based print management system. Dump your print servers and discover the future of print management with PrinterLogic. Find out more and get a free 30-day trial at printerlogic.com/packetpushers.
Welcome to Heavy Strategy, the show which is about unanswered questions instead of unquestioned answers. The idea here is to discuss a given topic, not really to tell you how to do it or how to solve it. That's your problem, not ours. Our idea is to try and surface questions that we should all be thinking about so you can pick out which questions you need to answer in your situation. Now, one of the topics that's been resonating right the way through most of 2023 is this idea of returning to the office or the end of remote work. And I think it would be fair to say that most companies, especially large companies, have been taking a harder and tougher line demanding that employees come back to the office. And they've gone from a, yes, we're coming back to the office, come back, to a mandated 2-3 days a week. Now it's a 3-4 days a week. And we're seeing increasing signals from various companies saying, no, it's a return to the office in full. At the same time, however, what we are also seeing is that a series of articles and a series of reports from way across the space is that if you are willing to advertise and take on remote workers, you can get unprecedented numbers of applications. You can pick and choose who you want for the role. You can pick the best people. So what we're seeing is people are, yes, they're coming back to work because that's where the money is, but they're also out there hunting for other jobs too. And if the opportunity presents itself to go remote, which I think, Jonah, begs the question, what does return to the office mean in, you know, the fourth calendar quarter of 2023? And what does it mean for 2024? Is it a bust? Is it going to go forward? Where's the problems? Now, you've done a research report on this. You've spent some days researching all the topics. Where do you want to start?
Well, I think I'd like to start with the first question, Greg, is, you know, what are the claims driving return to the office? Because you have high profile folks like Jamie Dimon saying, oh, we need people to return to the office because productivity has suffered. Well, it turns out productivity has not, in fact, suffered. And Jamie Dimon, being a finance guy, might actually know this. Corporate profits, which are really the ultimate measure of productivity, were 10% higher in July 2023 than in July 2020. Corporate profits have actually gone up since pre-COVID times as well. Mm-hmm. So profitability has gone up. Productivity has gone up.
So much so. Remember we did that show on the Great Layoff about all the people, tens of thousands? It's my thesis that productivity was up so high during the pandemic and the period of remote work that they were able to ditch 10% of their staff to do the same amount of work. And once you ditch the percentage, all of a sudden profits grow. So there was a productivity increase, allowed more product, more productivity, more services delivered for lower cost. And then they actually turned around and sacked the people who made that happen and booked that as a profit. That's my thesis. Is that viable?
I actually don't care, because my main point is that the numbers show in black and white that profitability is up. Therefore, every claim that profitability that remote work hurts profitability is false on its face. Mm-hmm. So whether they got there and then sacked people or whatever, that's nice. That's interesting. It's a side thing. But the main thing is, if you have a senior manager saying productivity is down because of remote work, they are wrong. They are lying. Unless there is a special case that I'll get to in a little bit. So I thought maybe there is something to do. You know, one of the concerns that I think both you and I have is that the real driver here is the sunk cost in real estate. And as I'll get to, that's actually something that I believe is really valid. But let's take a look at what that real estate actually costs on a per employee basis. And what you'll find, I'll jump to the findings, that depending on how much you're paying your employees, you are actually spending anywhere from 25 to 80% of the annual cost of that employee in real estate and associated costs. 80%. Think about that. You're basically saying, hi, I want to almost double my labor costs because reasons. No sane manager says that. Even if productivity dipped a little bit, the idea is if you can eke another 10% off the cost of your labor force, as you pointed out, you would do that, right?
That's right.
So just to throw the numbers behind this in case anybody's running, basically what you're looking at for the annual cost per square foot of office space is roughly US-wide $455 The square footage per employee is 163, so that means the annual real estate cost per employee is $74,000. The average employee makes something like $80,000 if you're counting office workers, which presumably are the people that you're actually housing in offices. Now, that said, you know, that's that does run a little low for certain geographies, and we'll talk about that. And then you have an additional, call it $3,000 to $5,000 for maintaining that office space, which is non-negligible. So you get to roughly $77,000 per $80,000 employee. That's really bonkers. That makes no sense. Why would you double that? Well, most people will then say, oh, well, wait a minute. Actually, when you talk about, like, Greg, you were talking about all the big layoffs, you're talking about laying off people who make $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year, not $80,000. And okay, that is a mitigating factor. But guess what? In those geographies, not only are the people more expensive, but the actual facilities costs are actually more expensive. Even if you say, for the sake of argument, Google or whoever has the cheapest office facility costs in the, you know, in the region, you're still talking about 26% of the salary of that employee. That's basically an add-on tax that the company is paying. These people are not stupid. They don't inflate their largest costs, or one of their largest costs, by 25 to 80% for reasons. I want to highlight the fact that, number one, productivity has gone up, not down. And number two, return to the office is super expensive, or at least
office facilities. And you're not even accounting to the fact benefit schemes that they're having to put in place. So most companies are saying—
I am actually, yeah. But
yeah, okay.
So, we're including their benefit. You know, benefits are basically run from anywhere from 1.2 to 1.3%. 120 to 130% of the salary. So you throw that in and yes, all that happens. But the reason I didn't really focus on it,
I guess what I was thinking is that you have— a number of companies are struggling to get employees to come back to the office. So they're starting to say, oh, we're going to cater your lunch for you, because at home you would make it yourself and it would be a nice lunch. Whereas if you come to the office, you have to go and buy less than per.
I've heard that anecdotally. Yeah. I haven't actually studied that. So I can't, you know, I can't put a pencil on a piece of graph paper and say, I know this is happening. But yes, anecdotally,
it is. The research I did, it's fairly consistent. There's some sort of benefits. It could be a catered lunch. It could be an uplift for travel fees or petrol fees, so petrol and parking. So a lot of people who aren't, you know, now that they're commuting to the office, they're saying, well, hang on, I'm now $300-$400 a week worse off because I have to pay for petrol and parking, right? I can come into the office, but I would like to get some contribution towards that. Or perhaps a more salient one is women or men who have been sharing childcare. When they come back to the office, because they're all coming back usually on something like a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, or a Tuesday to Thursday, something like that, they have to get childcare to cover those days, where before they didn't. And they're now saying, well, okay, if you want me to do that, I am now going to incur extra costs. Now, that's not— just to be clear here, that's not an across the board. That is, people are saying, look, if I'm coming back to the office, I have to pay for these costs. This is why I don't want to come back to the office. So the company then has a choice. It can be feel like it's being held hostage, or it feel like it's at saying, well, that's a valid concern. What can I do to help you? I could give you some, you know.
And actually, one of my favorite responses, I was walking through this thesis with a client of mine, and he commented that his wife's employer, which happened to be Samsung, and I'll give them a shout out, is requiring return to the office. And I was pounding the table and explaining why that was nuts. And he said, no, actually, it's not nuts. Here's what Samsung said. Hey, guys, we realize that this is an imposition on you for everything you've just said. We're not going to tease you with stupid foosball tables or food in the office. Here's a, you know, and I forget what the percentage was, so don't take it as gospel, but I think it was a 5 or 7% increase in your salary, because we want you to be in the office for our reasons. We understand that's an imposition on you. Here's more money. And she's like, sure, that works for me.
Now, that is a 360-degree turnaround from where we were 3 years ago or 2 years ago, when companies like Facebook was the one that was in my mind, where Zuckerberg was on the record as saying, if you're going to go remote, we're going to pay you less.
Yes, exactly.
Do you remember that?
I do. And I just remember thinking, Samsung, good move, guys, because that everything you just said about the talented employees, they get a win-win. They get the best and the brightest because they're paying a premium and they're recognizing the real economics here. Which
and then,
is
of
like,
course, if you do go remote, if you choose not to come to the office, you don't get the financial edge.
Right. Well, I don't know that they're offering actually offering a choice at that level. They're kind of saying, we want you in the office, and we realize that that's not optimal for you. So this job requires you in the office. So if you want it, you will get it at a premium. That's my understanding. That said, I haven't actually interviewed Samsung. So if anybody's listening from Samsung and knows otherwise, hit us up on, you know, packetpushers.net, FU, and give us some follow up, and we'll happily read it out on the show.
Let's pause the conversation for a word from sponsor Printer Logic. Remember how the future was going to be paperless? Yeah, not so much. And where there's paper, there's printers and print servers. If you're tired of dealing with print-related tickets, Printer Logic offers a simple, scalable, cloud-native, centralized, direct IP printing platform. Connect your print environment to easily manage front and back-end printing, integrate with EMR and ERP solutions, and get visibility and security. Say goodbye to print servers and reduce print tickets by up to 90% with Printer Logic. Find out more and get a free 30-day trial at printerlogic.com/packetpushers. That's printerlogic.com/packetpushers. And now back to the podcast.
So it's been very interesting to watch that. There's been a lot of other smoke sort of going around. What we have seen is a number of property investors saying that they're very concerned about the value of commercial real estate because it now has much less value. And that is going to take, it's taken me a while to see, say, well, why haven't we seen that happening? Why is it that they're saying that, or why is it, but that just not showing up in the prices? And the answer is because most commercial real estate deals are 5 and 10 and 20 years, like 10 plus 10, or you've got a 10-year, you're 5 years into it. The effects of that aren't going to be felt until those leases come up and get renegotiated. Now, we've seen, when I was doing my research, I found any number of articles about, Facebook, for example, in London had a $200 million lease on a building for the next 20 years. They just paid I think it was like $100 million or some very large, multiple tens of millions break fee to let that go. Now, either Facebook is not in planning to grow in the UK, or they're not in planning to increase office space in the UK because people are working remotely more often.
And I think you've hit on, I was going to lead up to that, but I think you've jumped right into the core, as you often do, which the real issue, if you follow this all the way down, essentially what's happening is these very large companies, and it's usually the very large companies that are demanding, pounding the table and demanding return to the office. Here's the kicker. These commercial real estate is a big asset on their books. That asset is going to get massively devalued, and they are going to get a haircut as Deutsche Bank.
Yes, the company value,
Yeah, and they're going to get smacked in the bonus. And so the Jamie Dimons of the world are going, no, you know what? I actually want to keep making my, you know, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars a year because I'm such a great company leader. I don't want to get smacked by Wall Street or on my stock price because I'm sitting on top of a giant asset that's going to be devalued in like 3, 4, 5, 10 years.
Yes.
Or, you know, more like 3, 4, 5, because now we're 3 years in.
Now we've also seen political leaders talk the same topic because they're saying, look, my city centers are dying. I've got restaurants going out of business because they used to rely on the lunchtime trade. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is that what they're starting to realize is that if office blocks go down, they just have to rezone them to be residential.
Well, that's a whole nother discussion because it turns out it's super expensive to you can't just rezone them. You actually have to rip the office block almost apart to rebuild it because, you know, plumbing is different. Everything's different. Lighting's different.
Yes.
But coming back to this, what we actually have when you strip away all the fluff, what we actually have is corporate leaders doing something because it's going to hurt them in the wallet. It's going to hurt them in the prestige if they don't do it. And then they're blaming their employees for it. They're saying, it's your fault productivity went down when in fact it didn't go down. And they're taking an enormous hit somewhere else, which is on the cost of labor, because they know they can get away with it. Because as you pointed out, Greg, they can just fire the people if they need to. They're stuck with these 10-year leases or the ownership of these. So, it's really pretty nefarious when you think about it.
So the question sticks in my mind, why are these CEOs, and the headlines are all around big companies, but this also implies all the way down, mid-level, small companies. I think there's a few things. One of the things that I saw is following Andy Jassy, and there's a lot of discussion around AWS, who's been ramping up the pressure on employees to come back to the office. And there's a definite sense that Jassy is becoming more and more frustrated by people refusing to come back.
Because it's his bonus at stake. It's his bonus at stake, and he's not going to say that.
Yeah, perhaps, but
not
I think
perhaps. That, it, that, that, I mean, that's this is you say why, and the why is blazingly simple. It's literally the balance sheets of the companies go down.
Amazon, don't believe that Amazon owns a lot of the office blocks it sits in. It may do. It is partially a real estate company, but.
Yeah, it is very much a real estate company. And that's the problem. I mean, I think you can probably, and I haven't done this, and if somebody's listening to me and they're skeptical, by all means, go out and look at the balance sheets of all these public companies and tell me what they're listing for real estate assets. I would love to see that. I haven't gotten
there. One quote I saw where somebody was pressing Andy Jassy, and he said, "Well, I don't have any data to justify coming back to the office, but I've spoken to 60 or more other CEOs, and we all agree that it would be better if people came back in the office." So, but I mean, AWS or Amazon is one of famously the most data-driven companies.
Right.
And this is just one of I've read like hundreds of articles on this return to work thing in the last 2 days, and not a single CEO can put a finger on why they want them to come back other than I want that, or the senior management has agreed that this is what needs to be done for the culture or for teamwork or collaboration without any data whatsoever.
And that's why I led this, led this episode with the data, because the data is absolutely in black and white. Productivity has gone up.
Yeah.
And keeping office space for employees is tantamount to doubling the cost of your up to doubling the cost of your labor force, anywhere from 25% to, literally 100%. No sane CEO is the data. Black and white. No sane CEO can back that up. So instead they kind of do the fluffity culture blah blah blah. And at the end of the day, you basically are left with two hypotheses. The people running very large companies are insane, which they can't really be because they've managed to amass massive fortunes, or they're worried about a hit to their massive fortunes that we haven't actually figured out. When you look at their real estate holdings and what you said earlier, Greg, that's the whole point. They're at the precipice of these black and white lines on their balance sheets going south. And when that happens, their stock prices go south, the market loses faith in them, and they get smacked, and they get, their bonuses go away. It's that simple. And that's why
I don't think it's even that intelligent. That would be assuming. I disagree. Now, let me show you why. I'm quoting here from another article. This is from Fortune, and they were interviewing somebody from.
Yes, of course,
they
never screw up.
This is quite recent, and they were talking to Peter DeSantis, who was this SVP of utility computing, and he said, "Being in the office is important because it helps with high-speed decision making, mentoring, and identifying the future leaders of the company." Well, if you have to do that face to face, that sounds to me like gut feel, shoot from the hip, I've met this person and I like them type stuff. That's not leadership. That's getting rid of diversity. That is focusing on people like me that I want to have around me type stuff.
Well, and I couldn't agree more, Greg. And in fact, there's two responses to that. One we've already made, but I want to reiterate it for completeness, which is that is leadership using a paradigm from the 1700s. And remember that all of our corporate leadership comes from military leadership models that were developed in the 1700s and 1800s, which were for better top-down command and control. I have to see everybody. I have to micromanage every major decision. And what's happened is even the military's realized that doesn't work very well. And without going in a huge long tangent about that, what they're adopting is something called mission command, which essentially means we call it adaptive leadership. It essentially means actually empowering small groups of people to make decisions very quickly on their own without having to run it up the flagpole. There's a whole lot more, and we're not going to talk about that this time, but that's one thing. The other elephant in the room that they're actually missing is AI. And let me give you an example. One of the classic reasons that everybody says, oh, we need people in the office, like take an advertising agency. Oh, we need people in the office so they can be doing pitch sessions where they're figuring out what the pitch is going to be, developing the campaign. Guess what the one thing that AI is actually good at is? Ideation. Coming up very quickly with a huge range of ideas that you can then curate and select from and double tech test to make sure they're valid. Well, guess what? AI doesn't live in an office.
No.
And that's
and
the thing.
And it doesn't work better in an office.
And it doesn't work better in an office, and it doesn't require face-to-face interactions. So anyone who's saying, I require face-to-face interactions, aside from the fact that they're using an outdated management technique, has yet to come to grips with the fact that they're going to be managing a mix of human and AI workforce going forward. And AI doesn't care at all about any of that.
Now, I just want to extend this idea about diversity, which I said. One of the things that strikes me about being in an office is that when you work in an office, you lose autonomy and you get much less empowered. Now, the reason that I say that is that when you're surrounded by people around you and you're forced to work in an office, you're all forced to wear a uniform. So everybody wears approximately the same clothes and everybody's expected to behave in a similar way. Everybody answers the phone. You're expected to be available to be interrupted. Your attitude is suspected to be the same. So you end up with this convergence of approaches. Now, one of the things that's coming to light a lot in the corporate research that I'm reading coming out of, even of all people, McKinsey and those types of companies, is that there is value in diversity, diversity of opinions, diversity of perspectives. And I think this is going to loop back to your AI thing, right? If you have a much more diverse group of people with divergent mindsets and divergent perspectives looking at what AI generates, you're going to be able to detect the bombs in there, right? People who look at words differently, people who look at topics and understand how they fit. And I think forced work in the office leaves workers unempowered for all, nearly all types of work. This all assumes that your work doesn't require access to a special physical machine that you actually... So this is not factory workers and all that. This is white-collar knowledge workers who do non-specific tasks, right? One thing that we know about them is that they are empowered and left to be autonomous. They do better work overall. There is always a risk, of course, that there are people out there. I mean, one of the things that I've seen a lot of these CEOs talk about is when I leave people doing remote work, sometimes they're taking on side hustles or they're doing two jobs. You know, they're working for two companies at the same time. Nothing upsets an executive more than thinking that they're working for two companies at the same time. But what does it matter? What does it matter? You know, and there are sure there's going to be some people slacking off, but I promise you, even if they're in the office, they'll still be slacking off. You just won't be so visible. It's not as visible or easily detected as people think. So I feel like if you come into the office today, this was not true 5 years ago. It was true 5 years ago, but we accepted it as a necessary thing. It removes your ability to be autonomous, to move in directions that suit the company best, and it reduces your empowerment, your ability to say, this is the direction that I need to take my work for the best role. I wonder if that's something that they don't like, losing control and getting a diverse set of employees with much more independent thought, and they see that as a threat.
Well, let's unpack a little bit of what you said, because I think you've hit on multiple important topics. The first one is diversity. I completely concur, although the one paper that I hang my diversity hat on apparently came out of NASA like 30 years ago, and I haven't been able to find it ever since. But they actually did some very granular quantitative testing, and they wanted to see, and this was just gender diversity, they wanted to see whether all male teams, all female teams, or mixed teams did better. No surprise, it turned out the mixed teams did measurably better, but it was interesting to see the different ways that the men and the women would go off the rails. Now, this was the culture in 30 years ago. Things may have changed. So I will say, while I believe fully that diversity is important, and I would, you know, with no data, I would certainly side with McKinsey. The problem is there are quite a lot of people who believe that diversity is a canard. It's just woke. It's allowing people who can't really succeed on a meritocracy to have a say at the table.
Well, let me just interrupt you there. Wokeism is generically a U.S. concept. That's not to say it's not creeping into other countries, but by and large, wokeism as a thing is, you know, or a social aspect is very, very much a U.S. thing.
And for those of you who are in other countries, the basic premise is where I was going with this, which is that it's an excuse for people who are not as qualified to get a seat at the table that they haven't earned. And they're not as qualified. And we know they're not as qualified because they are, their skin is browner, or they are female, or they're differently abled, or they're neurodivergent, or all the reasons that straight white male is, they're not straight white males.
Yes.
Now, obviously, you hear from the way I'm saying this that I don't believe that particular point of view. But the problem is, if you go back and argue to most of senior management today, well, you know, people lose diversity by being in the office. they're going to say, kind of smile and go, yes, I suppose that's a problem. But look at this Black woman that we've appointed the head of our diversity office. So we'll fix it that way. Meaning they don't really see it as a problem. You know, they hire somebody to do what they consider make work and they go on to something actually important. So while I think you're correct on diversity, the fundamental problem is most people don't accept that diversity has actual tangible Black and white value. I wish they did, but they don't.
So let's turn to the culture question.
Yes.
Which is one that we often see. So these executives and leaders and management often talk about, we need you to come in so that we can build a culture. And the first thing that strikes me here is, what happens when you're in an office full of people who don't want to be there, who know that they can be doing exactly the same thing without having to get there? And this is your point to remember, that the office kitchen is all awful. The toilets are not as good as your toilet at home. You're probably able to use nice toilet paper, you know, or the toilet at home is probably cleaner than the one in the office. You've probably got a lot more natural lighting versus, you know, office lighting, and you're not stuck in air-conditioned thing. Now, that I'll be straight up here. I did used to go to the office so that I could get warm in winter, because the office was often heated, whereas my home, you know, you might think I could save some money by turning the heating off. But I mean, what happens to an office and the culture if there's an office of which substantially more than half the people don't want to be there? What does that culture look like? What happens? I don't have an answer for that, by the way.
And I actually really question the whole culture thing, because it's always invoked to support return to the office. And when you really push people on what they mean, they can't really articulate it. While it's true that culture is a thing, culture has to start, a good culture, just to play off what you're saying, a good culture has to start with authenticity. And if you can't authentically acknowledge, hey, we're making you put up with something that's kind of unpleasant because we think it's important. You know, again, Samsung is upfront with that. Fine. Everybody's like, I'm not happy to be here. I'd rather be at home in my cozy little home office with my flower garden. But hey, you're paying me, so I'll do it because it's work and I'm doing it for the money in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, any culture that isn't based on authenticity is not really a culture. And hopefully what people have picked up from listening to this is that all the reasons for return to the office are not based on authentic facts.
No. Let me ask you this one, right? If you start thinking about what is the purpose, what is the value of a company? And if you aren't coming into an office, what is a company, right? So what happens to your perception of a company entity if it's just a gaggle of remote employees? Now, okay, let's come back again. Like, if you have a factory and you're producing widgets and there are machines, it's different, right? So this discussion excludes all of that. But let's say that you were someone running a purely technology company that was producing software and your only deliverable is a website. This is really ephemeral. The only physical aspect of your company doing a thing together is if people actually turn up on site. They turn up in the office every day, right? So if you're an executive and perhaps you're not thinking in detail about these things, in other words, you're incompetent, right? Do you suddenly feel that your company has disappeared when everybody's just online somewhere?
I think it's even more than what you're saying, Greg, because it's not just feeling that, it's actually that almost everything, certainly here in the US, is predicated on the notion of facilities. I mean, it's so built into our culture, our actual laws and regulations. So let me give you two examples. The IRS requires a physical headquarters for your office. It doesn't matter. It matters where. You have to pick someplace. But if there isn't one, they get super uncomfortable with the whole notion of, well, there really isn't one. And I don't know how they're going to deal with taxing AIs, but that's a whole different question. But right now, if you can't have a post office box even. I mean, you have to have a physical operating headquarters. And the other thing is, the entire lending process in the United States is predicated on real estate. If you want to get a loan, you go in and you say, here's my factory, here's my office space, I'm putting this down so that I can get my loan, and on you go. So the fact that you're making widgets in that factory space, the actual value that you're producing has no value in terms of collateral for the loan. The only thing that has collateral is the land and the building. And sorry, the only thing that has value. Yeah. So it's not just a feeling, it's literally how everything operates. And taking real estate out from its position of primacy as underpinnings for all of, you know, commercialization is going to be wrenching. And I say is going to be, because, you know, okay, you got a couple people on a podcast arguing that, you know, leading CEOs don't know what they're talking about. Big whoop. Who are you going to listen to, us or the billionaires? Well, yeah. The problem is,
well,
reality has a way of catching up. So it doesn't matter how much they stand there and pound the table.
Increasingly, people are stopping listening to the billionaires because the billionaires have been shown to be, you know, emperors with no pants sort of thing. Increasingly, we're seeing, you know, they just got lucky and they got convinced of their superiority and then told everybody about their superiority. And everybody looked at, you know, and said, well, these people must know. And it's what's becoming clear, you know, as these billionaires make more and more silly moves, stupid errors, are shown to be personally bankrupt, morally bankrupt, et cetera, et cetera. I think there is a definite, much more cautiousness, you know, towards what a billionaire says. Let me ask you one last question here. If you, I could see that coming back to the office would work in the following two conditions. So let me just try and describe it. One is if you've got a company which has very high staff turnover, and that means constant onboarding, constant relationship building, constant role forming. So that is, as new people come on, you've got to choose roles. You've got to say, this person's got skills here, therefore I need this person to step into this area where this skill set's not being addressed. I think that works. You know, that adaptation to an unstable environment or a high growth environment might work for face-to-face situations. And I also think another area where is if you've got poor management and poor job descriptions, or you've got uncontrolled workflows where people in the, you know, the teams on the floor just work out how to solve problems amongst themselves without any guidance from management or anything like that. And then you go through, or you're going through repeated restructuring. So one of the things that we see, particularly in companies like Amazon, for example, is that they're constantly dissolving teams, destroying departments and rebuilding them somewhere else, redeploying people somewhere else. And I think that there's a case to be made that if you're going through that sort of a work environment, that sort of cultural environment where nobody really knows what they're doing, they know roughly what direction they're going, but the tools that you use and the processes that you create between people about, if I do this, I know that you're doing that. It may be that face-to-face actually helps there. But what I would also question is that a productive environment? Is that a viable work environment to get much done?
Well, I'd like to split that again into two pieces. Mm. One is just general bad management, and I want to address that in a second because it's a different answer. The first one, I would absolutely agree that face-to-face helps in that environment, but what I would stress is it's not the ordinary office where you go to a cubicle or you're hoteling or whatever. There, what I would recommend and what I've seen work is that you have frequent, but not every single day, group interactions where, okay, we've just dissolved this team, we're mixing up the new team, everybody come in for a week, and we're going to interact in this space that's designed to interact. So you get to know your teammates, sort yourselves out, and I'll run for the next 3 or 4 weeks or whatever it is, and then do it all over again. So it's much more of, what was it you were using the last time, the punctuated equilibrium model where people come in.
But I think there's a lot of companies for whom punctuated equilibrium happens every week because the companies are destructively organized. That there's a culture of just letting, you know, not
yes,
knowing
what they're doing. In that case, if every single employee is getting reorganized every week, then no. What you actually see is different waves of employees. So this week it's these employees, that next week it's those employees. And there's usually a period of a couple of months where they're allowed to run.
Companies which have very high headcount turnover as well. So I'm thinking of cloud companies. Where they, one of the things that we're seeing a lot of U.S.
Even
corporates
so,
do, you know.
Even so, though, I mean, realistically, cloud companies have people geographically dispersed. I mean, there's really no environment where you don't allow people a little bit of stability, because otherwise you don't get anything done. If people are just constantly meeting each other, hi, nice to meet you. Oh, tomorrow I'm working with someone else. Oh, the next day I'm working with someone else. It's not, you're not producing in that environment.
I can envision an idea where, let's say, you're working in a team of, say, 12 to 18 people.
Right.
And on any given month, you lose two of those people. Right. That is quite normal inside of AWS,
could be,
for example. I know that for a fact. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't see that necessarily those two people that you're losing or gaining are going to be geographically in the same spot. So, you know, how is that happening? So,
you know, one person goes off to join another company, another person goes off to join another team. They are going for an internal
promotion. What I'm saying is they never were working in the same physical space. Some of them might be anywhere across the country. So it's not like you were, you know, I still think it can be solved by using office space differently and allowing people to interact differently. And I mean, I've done that myself, so I know it can work.
Well, I do also think I think that people in the, even in those environments, if you had good use of tools, video conferencing, chat sessions, and so forth. And I think one of the challenges that we face right now is, like, for example, I'm looking at Zoom because we record these over Zoom. Zoom has now added chat and alerts and calendaring integrations and all these things. So one of the challenges that we've got is that the tool sets that we use to communicate or collaborate are actually changing underneath our feet. And we often don't know, like, sometimes I get alerts on my, you know, devices saying there's something, and it's an alert from an app that I didn't realize suddenly had a chat session or, you know, whatever, or this feature. And I think one of the iteration or the problems that we have is that the tools are trying to, you know, add value, but all they're doing is being disruptive and preventing good quality work from being done sometimes. You know, Slack has added video conferencing and audio calls that seemed like a good idea until you realize that now you've got Zoom and then you've got Teams and now you've got a telephone and now you've got a mobile phone and you've got...
That's a whole different episode that I keep pushing for us to talk about, because these tools are really, as you said, changing under our feet. But I want to kind of wrap up for the last thing that you raised, which is, you know, what about the special case of, which is probably very common, companies with horrible processes? And the only way any work gets done is by people wandering around and finding the people who actually know how to get work done. Here's the thing. Here's the thing. One of my colleagues has pointed out that the best use of AI at the moment, and we've documented that the single biggest use case is streamlining internal operations. He posits that what you would want to do is feed all the interactions, human interactions, into an AI, which can then tell you the hotspots and say, this is where, like, imagine a big glowing glob and so parts of it are green and parts of it are red and parts of it are yellow. Well, the red parts are where there are no processes or nobody's ever following the processes. So you go in and fix that by developing the processes, or let the AI fix it by suggesting processes. And the greens are where the processes are good, and the yellows are where the processes are not as good. Well, once that happens, that's going to be the biggest single fix to that level of bad management, lack of processes that clash.
You're a bit optimistic. I don't think most senior management are even that self-aware or that technologically competent or willing to adopt technology as a solution to their incompetence, right?
Right, but it's AI. They already have.
That's the problem.
The Wall Street Journal ran an article yesterday about how CEOs are pushing their teams to adopt AI. So yes, they're not going to adopt Zoom or Teams, but they'll adopt AI.
Yeah. But the AI in Zoom is creepy.
I'm not talking about that. AI in anything is creepy.
Execution is separate from intention. From the potential of the technology.
I'm just talking about the possibility for technology to analyze, synthesize, and predict and suggest optimizations to bad human processes. Okay. That possibility is right across the horizon. I mean, it's not far out. And that's going to take away that excuse for having people.
Okay, I have one last point I want to make before we wrap this up. And one of the other things is that some companies are using RTO mandates as layoffs. And so what they want to do is do some downsizing, or they want to do some changes to the organization. And one way to do that without having to go around and just fire people and go through what is an ugly process, and quite often it's to do the emotional bankruptcy of the leadership team. They don't want to be seen as firing people. So they just put, you know, return to office mandates, and they say, well, whoever wants to come into the office is, they're like me. They're the people I want around me. Therefore, I'm going to get rid of all the remote workers. So just every now and then, everything that we said about this sometimes can just be a rather uncomfortable process for executives to lay off people in disguise. And companies are basically saying, we dare you to quit, because then we don't have to fire you and pay your termination bonuses. So it is a complicated, you can find that sometimes there are other motivations behind return to office. So just be aware of that in your specific situation, it might be different.
Well, and I would just wrap up to that saying that in such a scenario, it's usually the best and brightest who quit, not the least competent, because the least competent know what they can do to keep their jobs and they do it. The best and brightest know they can get new jobs. And so essentially that company is on the slow path to extinction.
Yes. And it's probably a fair sign for you to get that resume buffed up even more than it normally is and get it out there. Well, thanks so much for listening today. This has been Heavy Strategy. Thanks very much to Jonah. She works at Nemertes Research. That's NEMERTES.com. You can find her over there, join her community, where she actually maintains a group of people who contribute and chat, and you can get a hold of her and I at that location. I'm Greg Farrow from Packet Pushers. As always, you can find me over on Twitter and on LinkedIn, and we have our website. Lots of stuff there, lots of other channels in our network. There's been a massive overhaul. All our artwork is changing in the next week. We're going to have a new website, all modern and fancy schmancy looking. It's going to be exciting. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you again in a couple of weeks.